The following is an introduction lecture to the Bhagavad Gita as it is, given by His Grace Sriman Sankarshan Das Adhikari, recorded on February 1st, 2014, in Austin, Texas, USA.
You guys were the inspiration for starting this group because a lot of people have expressed interest, saying that we have the Bhagavad Gita, but it's difficult to study it together. So we wanted to create a forum where practitioners who are interested in this philosophy of the Gita can get together. And we thought it's auspicious to start with the monk who's been practicing the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita for over 4 decades. So we're very fortunate to have His Grace Sankarshan Das Adhikari Prabhu here with us. He's from Austin, and he travels around the world. Some of you have attended some of his talks earlier here. So he's going to introduce the Bhagavad Gita and set us off on this right journey for us to understand how we can apply Bhagavad Gita into daily life. So thank you so much again for coming. If you don't have a Bhagavad Gita, we have some copies out here and some notepads and pens. So
this is the beginning of a great adventure, Bhagavad Gita. It's very interesting to note, of course, this will just be an overview today, kind of an overview. It's interesting to note that 5,000 years ago, when Krishna spoke this Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, which is the actual place in India, you can go and see where the conversation took place. This is not just an allegory, it's an historical event. Krishna says that very ancient science of the relationship with the Supreme. So even 5,000 years ago, it was considered to be an ancient science. It wasn't started 5,000 years ago. It was simply re-spoken 5,000 years ago. So, this is a science of the relationship between the individual self and the Supreme Self. And that science means how to perfect one's relationship with the Supreme Self. In other words, how to be completely in a state of harmony, perfectly synchronized with the Supreme. When I was a kid, I used to play in the orchestra, the violin. So we learned how to synchronize with each other under the guidance of the conductor and make a nice sound, you see. Everybody just doing their own thing, then it's just like, you see. But if we're all working together under the guidance of the conductor who's following some beautifully composed music, you see, then it becomes a very pleasing thing. So, here the Supreme Conductor, Krishna, is speaking. And if we can harmonize with Krishna as he speaks in the Gita, then your life becomes like a beautiful poem or a beautiful song or a beautiful dance. It just becomes the most serene, peaceful, harmonious thing, even in the midst of intense situations like Monday morning at the office or, you know, a terrorist attack or anything that can happen in this material world. The Bhagavad Gita was spoken on a battlefield just prior to the battle. And Arjuna was in a complete state of transcendental ecstasy throughout the entire battle, and he won the battle also. So it's a very, very interesting book. It's sometimes described as the original psychiatric session. Arjuna had a nervous breakdown. He said, "I can't handle this, Krishna. I just can't handle this. It's too much." But Krishna taught him how to see everything in a transcendental way. Because beneath the veneer of the material energy is what we're seeing all the time. It's like we're seeing a screen. It's called the Mahatattva. We're seeing this screen out here of the material existence. But there's a lot more in there than what meets the eye. Even from a scientific viewpoint, there are certain light rays you cannot see with your eyes, but you can, you know, with the proper instrument, ultraviolet rays or infrared rays. With an instrument, you can actually see what you can't see with your eyes. So this is a more powerful instrument than anything the scientists have dreamed of. This is a more powerful instrument that allows you to see what nobody else can see, what's actually behind the universe, what's actually making it function, why everything's happening the way it's happening. So when you have that very deep, deep vision of what actually what's going on, then you can handle everything perfectly, better than anyone else, and be completely peaceful and happy in all circumstances. The beautiful, the ugly, every situation actually is beautiful if you can see it at a deep enough level. So the Gita is a wonderful book, how to actually have that transcendental vision. One of the key verses in this book is in chapter 9, text number 2. I'll give you the Sanskrit. It's very beautiful. Rajavija rajaguyam pavitram idamutamam pachakshavagamam dharmyam shushukam kartamavyayam. Translation is, this knowledge is the king of education. It is the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting and it is joyfully performed. So now let's look a little bit at the history. You can see there's a beautiful painting here just inside the cover. It's a huge battle, 640 million warriors, if you can imagine. It's a world war, actually. But the wars in those days were much more civilized than we have today, just like, actually it was very organized, like an athletic event, if you can imagine. There was a specific place that was chosen, there were certain rules of conduct. There was no guerrilla tactics, everything was very gentlemanly, if you can imagine a gentlemanly war, but it was. That's why this conversation, you have these 640 million warriors assembled on either side. In the middle, this conversation is taking place. While all the warriors are getting ready to fight. And no one's going to fight before the allotted time. You know, everyone follows the rules. So Krishna and Arjuna are having this discussion in the middle of 640 million warriors getting ready to go to battle. The situation was that actually Arjuna and his brothers, they were the rightful heirs to the throne, but because they were not old enough as young boys when their father died, their uncle was given the temporary position, and he was blind, actually. So he couldn't really be king, but they were put under his direction, and his son was very wicked. So his son wanted to usurp the kingdom. And when these boys grew up, he didn't want them to get the, you know, that was their rightful. They were the heirs of the throne. So you have the pious Pandava brothers headed by with Arjuna and Yudhisthira. Then you have the impious sons of their uncle, Dhritarashtra, headed by Duryodhana, who were trying to steal the kingdom from them. And then you have Krishna, who's the supreme person, who actually was on the earth at the time. And he wanted that the pious men, instead of having some, you know, evil, wicked-minded people ruling, he wanted some pious men to rule. Because when pious men are ruling, then it becomes a very nice atmosphere for everyone. But they happened to be family members. It was all within a family. You had one group, it was between cousin brothers, you see. So Arjuna was a very, very pious, saintly man. He was one of the heirs of the throne, but he was thinking, as the battle was about to begin, he was thinking, it's better just let me just die in battle. I don't want to kill my kinsmen. I mean, these are my kinsmen. He wasn't thinking they were wicked, evil people, you know, usurping the kingdom. These are my relatives. How can I possibly fight this battle with my relatives? Better I don't fight. Even though he was a very famous warrior, he said, "No, I can't handle this." He just dropped his bow and arrow. He's right weeping. You know, he just couldn't handle it. Had a nervous breakdown. So then Krishna explained that actually, See, Krishna is the perfect knower of past, present, and future. He said, actually, they're already killed, so no question of you killing them. They're already killed anyway, so just you go forward and do your duty and get credit. But Arjuna was hesitant. So then Krishna explained the whole science of the self in relationship with the Supreme Self. All the basic principles, and we hear about yoga and karma, they're all coming from the Bhagavad Gita. So once Arjuna actually saw the real situation, what was really going on behind the scenes, the external energy, the material energy is superficial, but beneath it there's a whole spiritual, transcendental thing going on by the arrangement of the Supreme. So then once Arjuna had this divine vision, then he was able to fight the battle and not be disturbed. Actually, Krishna revealed his form as being everything. It's called the Virat Rupa, the universal form. So this book is not telling us that we should go out and fight. That's not the whole point. Even though Arjuna did fight the battle, this book is telling us that we should live in a state of harmony with the Supreme. And the science of how to do that is very, very thoroughly and nicely explained. You can consider your own body as an example. Your body is a unit. It's an organic unit that functions. The parts of the body function with each other. So the hand doesn't act independently. It acts in relationship with the body. If the hand doesn't, just for example, eating, you see the body requires nourishment. The hand also requires nourishment. So the hand, if it's broken, it can't pick up any food. It can't do its function. You have to go to a doctor to get it fixed. So when the hand is actually functioning properly, then it serves the complete whole body by putting the food in the mouth. That way the whole body is nourished, the hand also is nourished. So the Gita is teaching us, who are like the hands on the body, how to serve the complete whole. That's the science of how to actually dovetail the individual consciousness with the Supreme Consciousness. One learns how to do it on all levels, the more subtle mental level, the level also of speaking, and the level of acting. There's three different levels: thinking, speaking, and acting. Mind, words, and body. The speaking is actually a reflection of what's going on in our mind. And then you act out. You also act it out as well in your activities. So in the Bhagavad Gita, we learn the first thing we learn is how to purify our thoughts, how to harmonize our thoughts with the Supreme. Because once you do that, then your speech becomes amazing. You can speak things that are just, you can talk about things that are very, very powerful and very, very real and not understood by the general population. In other words, you actually become enlightened. By studying, applying Bhagavad Gita, you become an enlightened person. You become spiritually enlightened. Not as a result. And then naturally, you act in a way which is beneficial for all living entities. So in that state of pure thought, pure speech, and in beneficial activities, beneficial actions, and beneficial speech as well, then you become very, very satisfied and happy. The more you can actually serve, the more you become happy. It's like someone who does good for others, they develop happiness. The more you can serve others, the more you become happy. And the more you do not serve others, become a miser. Just like the word miser, notice the connection between the word miser and the word miserable. It's the same word, you see. The more you become miserly, the more you become miserable. And the more you, in other words, miser means take, 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 take. Give me, give me, give me. I just want to take as much as I can from everybody wherever I go. You see, that's a miser. But the opposite person, in Sanskrit, a miser is called kripana. And it's interesting, we have a slang word in English, creep. Yeah, he's a real creep. I know that word's still going around. When I was a kid, it was a, still use the word creepin', creep, yeah. Yeah, he's a real creep. So the Sanskrit word is creepin'. It means a creep. He's a real creep. He's a greedy, selfish character, a creep, a creepin'. So the opposite term is brahmana. You see, one who is always giving, 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 giving. He's always serving, or she, always serving, 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 serving. So there are many people who are engaged in many types of wonderful service, you know, humanitarian work, you know, social welfare activities, and that's very wonderful. But the Gita is the perfection of that, because when you actually serve the root of the tree, then every leaf and branch on that entire tree becomes served. So Gita is the science of how to water the universal root. Instead of watering the leaves, you can actually water the root. And by that watering the root, then everything becomes nourished. You become nourished. You're not left out. When you serve the Supreme Person, you, as part of Him, you become served as well, and you serve everyone else at the same time. So the Gita is that perfectional science of how to serve the Supreme perfectly. Of course, we're very crude in the beginning. We're, in this world, we're all more or less selfish. Everybody's selfish to a greater or lesser extent. That's our culture. That's how we are raised. And that's actually why we're frustrated. You see, that's, we're not meant to be selfish. We're meant to be selfless. So that the Gita brings us gradually, it's from that platform of selfishness to selflessness. It's a gradual evolution of consciousness that takes place as one begins to practice the science explained in Gita. If you have any questions as we go along, write them down, because we'll have a little question and answer session at the end. It's amazing. It took place in just a very short time, like a half an hour, 45 minutes. And it's also amazing. This is the speech was so elevated in those days. This is the actual words that Krishna and Arjuna spoke. And it's perfectly rhymed Sanskrit poetry. I mean, it's hard to conceive of that, but, you know, can you imagine having a conversation with somebody in perfectly composed poetry with meter and rhyme? Actually, it's like that. They're actually talking back and forth in perfectly metered and rhyming Sanskrit poetry. It's really very high. It's beyond what we can even conceive of. You can't conceive of somebody doing that nowadays. Even the most accomplished poets, can they just sit around and talk perfect poetry out of their mouths? No, they have to spend time, you know, writing it down, composing it, scratching out this, that, and it was just, you know, 45 minutes of beautiful Sanskrit poetry. We can't conceive of such a culture, but that's the culture that was on this planet 5,000 years ago. Not only in India, but that planet, that culture was worldwide. I've seen signs of it, actually. Hitler did not invent the swastika. He actually took it from the ancient Indian culture, and he turned it over. He flipped it over, that rascal man. But, you know, that was a sign of original Vedic culture. I went to a museum one time in Houston, and it showed the dress of an Indian squaw, American Indian squaw. And guess what was on it? A swastika. And the museum noted, this symbol has appeared in many cultures around the world which are not related with each other. That's what I put on the. I put a note like this. This is ridiculous. If that symbol is appearing all over the world, then there's some connection. So actually, the Indian culture was spread all over the world. This culture, which was centered in India, 5,000 years ago, was a worldwide culture. But we entered into an age called the Age of Kali, which is an age of quarrel and hypocrisy, an age of materialism. When spiritual values are thrown out the window, greed, lust, anger become the theme of the day. So, therefore, the culture has been lost. So now we can all, by studying the Gita and following it, we can revive it. We can be part of a spiritual, you can be a part of a spiritual renaissance. Just by having your own awakening within your own heart, and that will gradually influence people that you associate with. You see, as you become spiritually awakened, other people who are relating with you, they'll be affected by you. So it's actually pretty exciting to be part of a great spiritual revolution that's been predicted to take place starting 500 years ago. There's supposed to be, of course, it's not coming as fast as we'd like it to come. And things in many ways are getting worse in the material world. But for those who actually take to this understanding of Gita, their life is getting better and better and better, you see. Because right now we all have what's called karmic baggage from this life and previous lifetimes. We're suffering and enjoying all kinds of reactions for past pious and impious activities. But by following this Gita, what you're doing is you're completely purifying all of them. There's three kinds of karma. There's called karma, which means pious activities. There's vikarma, which is impious activities. And there's upkarma, which means no karmic reaction. You're acting in a transcendental way which does not bring any material reactions. So the Bhagavad Gita teaches you how to enter into the realm of a karma, which wipes out your previous karma, you see. In other words, you don't have to, you may have been fated to suffer in so many ways by doing something, some dastardly act in a previous lifetime, you see. But by taking up this Gita pathway, it's excused. Your karmic slate is, the more that you absorb yourself in following these teachings, your karmic slate becomes, okay, you're forgiven, you don't have to take that reaction. It's like sometimes they give you a pardon, they strike it off your criminal record, you know. You make a deal with the legal authorities to have it taken off your record so you have a clean record. So you get a clean karmic, by taking up this practice, you actually get a clean karmic record. You could have been the most heinous of all sinful persons. There was two drunkards 500 years ago in Navadvip. They were like the local mafia, and they were really horrible characters. They were raping women, murdering people, robbing. I mean, they were just the most, you know, they were like really, really horrible characters. But they took up this pathway and became great saints. All that was completely wiped off their record. And so it's a very powerful thing. Does anybody have any questions so far? Okay. How are these teachings similar or different from other religious teachings? It's a very interesting question. To put it in a very brief term, is religion is one. In its pure form, it's one thing. But in our impure state, in our conditioned state of consciousness, we divide it out and we fight, you see. This is our imperfection. We take the pure thing and we divide it out into this thing, this sect, that sect, this sect. In the sects, you know, you have you divide up Christianity, Judaism, Islam. Then within that, you know, like Islam, you get the Sunnis and the Shiites battling it out with each other. You just keep dividing the sects and you keep fighting. It's just crazy. It's missing the whole point. It's the politicization of the pure thing. It's been politicized. So, if you actually get to the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, in fact, Krishna actually says, give up all religions and just connect yourself with the Supreme. That's actually the key verse. Give up all religions, just connect with the Supreme. Nowadays, a lot of people are fed up with all this sectarianism. They say, just give me spirituality. I don't need all this sect, that sect. It seems to be very materialistic to me, you see. So Bhagavad Gita is actually the highest level spirituality text that you can find that really, in a very simple, clear way, describes the perfection of spirituality. How to get to the original pure form, religion with a capital R, not the little r's like nowadays, you see. Actual religion and spirituality are the same thing, but now they're in the common languages being divided into two things because religion has been, the word religion has been very much abused. So the actual meaning of religion is from the Latin religio, which means to relink. Or like we say, yoga. You see, yoga means link. There's different types of yoga, but they all have the same, ultimately lead to the same point of linking with the Supreme, being fully connected or dovetailed with the Supreme. So that's the real meaning of religion. And there are many great saintly teachers who taught religion in different times and places according to different audiences. And so they would present it in different ways because of a different audience. But the actual essence is the same. There's a Supreme, and we are meant to be in perfect harmony with that Supreme. That's the essence of religion in its original pure form. So as soon as we want to try to exploit others and name religion, then we make all these different, you know, holier-than-thou type of teachings. You know, if you're not part of our sect, you're going to hell. I mean, I remember as a kid, I laugh about it now, or I cry about it too. I had a little girl next door, about my age, Joni Osdeck was her name, and she was a Catholic, and we were Presbyterians. Just from the training I got as a kid, I remember telling, Jesus doesn't love you, I told her. I mean, that's how I was trained. Yeah. I remember driving my parents in the car around town, and we saw a Catholic church, was like, ooh, a bunch of demons, you know. I mean, that's how I was trained. I just a little kid, I didn't know anything, but that's the kindness I got from my parents, you see. So, the Gita gets us beyond all that stuff, you see. It's only Allah, it's only Jesus. Allah is the only way, Jesus is the only way, this is the only way, that's... Actually, they're all the only way. They're all the only way. Truth is one, religion is one, God is one, you see. Now, the names may be different. It's like these flowers. In Texas, we call them flowers. In Sanskrit, they're called pushpa, you see. It's the same thing, but the name is different. Are we going to fight? No, they're flowers. No, they're pushpa. Have a war with each other, you know. You're going to hell because you call it pushpa. You're going to hell because you call it flowers. I mean, that's the level of maturity we see in all this religious conflict in the world today. They're just fighting over names. It's ridiculous, you know. God is called God. You can't call him Ishvara. In other words, if you don't speak English, you're an illusion. Yeah. You know, you can't say God. You can't call God in Spanish. You can't call him in Arabic. You only can call him out to him in English. I mean, This is the depth of childishness, which has infected the religionists of the modern day. So, instead of talking about interreligious dialogue, which is reaffirming the idea there's different religions, I went to a nice interreligious dialogue gathering the other day. I mean, I feel very much at home. I was happy to see so many religious peoples. It was a guy from the Buddhist temple, a guy from a Muslim mosque, it was Christian ministers, Baptist. I was felt very happy to be with so many religious people. But as soon as you're talking about interreligious dialogue, you're missing the whole point. Because the real point is, religion is actually one, you see. And that is, whether you call him Krishna, or Jehovah, or Allah, or Rama, or Adonai, there are many names for the Supreme according to different scriptures. But the essence is one. And that essence is loving relationship. Because then as soon as you water the root of the tree, then all the leaves and branches become nourished. As soon as you give your love to that Supreme Person, who's the source of all existence, by whose arrangement everything is coming, all the air we breathe, the water, the food, everything we have, all the facilities we've gotten, the iPhones, the automobiles, the forests, the manufactured things, the natural things, they're all God's energy, you see. So one should be grateful. Religion simply means an attitude of gratitude. That's what it really means, you see. You have to have an attitude of gratitude. I didn't manufacture this air I'm breathing. I didn't manufacture the water. It's not my invention. I didn't manufacture the apple or the grapefruit. These are gifts that are given to me, you see. I didn't manufacture my body. It's working so well. This one's going on for 66 years, you see. I didn't put it together out of some kind of kit I got from Sears and Roebuck. You know, this is some kind of amazing thing that I've been given, you see, by a higher power, you see. So if one develops an attitude of gratitude for everything that's there, and let me reciprocate with that person, providing everything. So much love that person is getting, let me reciprocate that love, you see. So Gita is a science of how to reciprocate love with the Supreme. That's the science. Krishna tells exactly what to do. You don't have to guess. He says, "Man manama mamad bhakto majadhi mang namaskuru. Om me vashasha yugvai vang atmanang matparayanaham." He says, engage your mind always in thinking of me. Become my devotee. Offer your homage unto me. Worship me. In this way, you'll become completely absorbed in me. So this is really perfection of meditation. When you fall in love with someone, you can't do anything but think about them 24 hours a day. You dream about them at night, you wake up in the morning, you can become completely absorbed in the thoughts of your beloved, you see. So that same tendency of falling in love or being in love or giving love, reciprocating love, Bhagavad Gita teaches us how to take that loving propensity that we all have and apply it in the Supreme Person. Now, because we're all, in this world, we're all selfish to a greater or lesser extent, none of us can really perfectly reciprocate love. I'm the center of the universe now, everyone can love me and I'll perfectly reciprocate. We can't do that. We're not capable of doing that. Of course, an enlightened being can do that. A spiritually, fully spiritually enlightened person can do that. But when we're not yet spiritually enlightened, we can't do that. We're still caught up on our own egotism, that I'm the center of the universe mentality. We're still caught up in that. So, by applying these principles of the Bhagavad Gita, then we actually learn how to start connecting with that Supreme Person. And the beauty of that Supreme Person is even though he has his abode far, far away, that Supreme Person is present within every atom, between every atom. He's fully present within the heart. So, once you actually learn how to connect with that Supreme Person, you can feel the presence of that Supreme Person wherever you go. You no longer, the loneliness ceases to be an issue in your life. You can be anywhere and never feel alone because you always feel the presence of the Supreme Person within your heart, blessing you, guiding you, helping you in every possible way to come closer and closer to Him, and empowering you to help other people who are suffering because they're disconnected from Him to come back to their original relationship with Him. Notice I said original relationship. See, originally we were in a state of perfect harmony with the Supreme. But it's like the little kid who was curious about that, about that stove, that beautiful blue flame on the stove. Oh, he wanted to check it out and see what it felt like. He burned himself, you see. So we, curiosity killed the cat. We were curious what it'd be like if we could be the center, if we could be the Supreme. So we thought we'd try sticking our hand in the fire and see what it was, how nice it is. And we got burned. Here we are in these material bodies, you see. But we can get back to our original position. It's not difficult because that Supreme Person is there wanting us back. And you can do it as whatever you're into. You can do it in that way. You can do it as a Christian, as a Jew, as a Hindu, as a Buddhist, as a philosopher, as a scientist, you know, as an artist. Whatever ism you're into, you can do the, you know, you can through that ism, you dovetailing yourself with the Supreme, you can become perfect. Not that you have to change from, you know, being a Baptist, being a Hindu, or, you know, you have to give up being a scientist and just become a romanticist or something like that. Whatever you're into, you can stay into it. But you take these principles of the Gita and you apply it to where you're into now and make it perfect, you see. I remember I was with my spiritual master. He said, if you're a lawyer, remain a lawyer. If you're a doctor, remain a doctor. You say, if you're a fool, remain a fool. We all laugh. But by applying these principles, one can actually come back into the contact of that Supreme Person. And at the perfectional level, you can actually see that Supreme Person. Some people say, well, there is a Supreme, but there's no personality there. But that's not really logical because, and it's, nor is it confirmed in the Vedic scriptures as well, because just like if you have a gold mine, you can get gold out of the gold mine. So that Supreme is the existential mine from which everything is coming, you see. So I'm a person, you're a person, isn't it? You're a person, aren't you? The scientists tell us we're robots, but I don't agree with them. If we're all robots, then why do they get so upset when their friend was killed in an automobile accident? You see, doesn't make sense. I'm a person, you're a person, we're all persons. We know we're not robots. I know that I'm a person because I have consciousness. A robot doesn't have consciousness, and we have, each one of us has consciousness. So there's an origin. We have personality, and consciousness is a symptom of personality. So therefore, since this is a goldless gold mine, cannot produce gold. A impersonal existential mind cannot produce persons. Therefore, because we are persons, we can understand the Supreme must possess personality as well. And what do people like? They like to be loved, isn't it? Don't you? Do you want to be hated or do you want to be loved? You see? We want to be loved. That's our nature. Even plants. There was an experiment done in one elementary school classroom. The teacher gave each student two plants of the same quality, of the same size pot, the same amount of dirt, and same amount of fertilizer, the same amount of water. Everything was the same temperature. Everything was the same, except the students were told to be very nice to one plant and be really nasty the other plant. Yeah, you plant, here's your water, you know. Be very, you know, cranky with one plant and be very sweet with the other one. And guess which plants thrived and which ones didn't thrive? I think you can understand the point. Even the plants can take, they know what it means to be loved. A plant knows what it means to be loved, you see. Well, to speak of human beings, we're even more sensitive than, you see, than a plant. So that love is a very important thing. And when you can actually have a loving relationship with the Supreme Person, as described very clearly in this great spiritual text, Bhagavad Gita, then you can become energized with love, energized with light, energized with wisdom, energized with enthusiasm, energized with patience, and energized with all divine qualities that are found in saintly people. And gradually you can become transformed into a saint, a living, breathing saint, right here in Austin, Texas. You see? You can be a living, breathing saint right here in Austin, Texas, just by applying these teachings very seriously. So I think I have another question here. Any more questions? Pass them up. We've just got another 15 minutes. How does Bhagavad Gita teach spirituality and how to understand it? Yeah. Spirituality means to understand that, I am a spirit. That's the first thing. I'm not this body. I'm spiritual. I'm not just a bunch of chemicals. There's something. This body is called a machine in the Bhagavad Gita. Yantra is the word used. So the spirituality means understand there's a spiritual nature beyond the material nature. And see the question again. Yeah. That's basically to understand there's a spiritual reality. It's not just, even through science, we understand there's things out there that we can't see with our gross senses, but you can pick them up with scientific instruments. So as I mentioned earlier, we have a scientific instrument more powerful than any microscope, more telescope, and any telescope, and that is consciousness. You have a scientific instrument more powerful than anything the scientists have ever dreamed up or ever will be able to dream up. And the Bhagavad Gita will teach you how to activate that consciousness, so you can actually achieve the state of divine vision. Okay. How would Bhagavad Gita help children to do their duty? The thing is, children naturally mold themselves after the parents. So if the parents are following this pathway very seriously, the children will naturally follow it. It's not that you impose something on your kids. That's missing the whole point. The point is, if you're in this pathway and you're actually manifesting the qualities found in this great teaching, the children will naturally follow your example because it's better than anything they can see around them. Their parents will be on a higher level of happiness, a higher level of consciousness than anyone else they know. Why were the Kauravas evil when Krishna was there? They were the rival parties. I mentioned the Kaurava branch of the family under Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana. Why? Well, in this material world, there is two. This is a world of where everyone is more or less selfish. Those who are more selfish, and those who are less selfish, and there are those who are also spiritually perfect. You see, so you have that natural polarity in this world. Good and evil, and those who are completely pure, the very rare souls who awaken their divine consciousness. It's a natural thing in this world. You're going to have, Krishna says, I come to deliver the pious and annihilate the miscreants. There is a natural division. Some people argue, well, it's all relative. But it's not, there is such a thing as good and evil. It's not that, you know, there's no such thing as evil, it's just we perceive it. No, there is such a thing as evil. Being cruel, love and cruelty are real realities. It's not that cruelty is just love and another man's type of love, you see. No. There is a thing as love, there's a thing as cruelty. So any other questions? Yes. Oh, very good. Thank you. So if Krishna says abandon all religions and just connect with the divine, what is the purpose of benefits of becoming an initiate? Okay. Yes, we do have in our Krishna consciousness process, according to these teachings, we do have a system of becoming a disciple, becoming initiated. So does it mean you're joining a religion when you do that? So is it contradictory? When I took up this pathway, did I join a religion? No. When I became an initiate, my spiritual master is here, and I became his disciple, did I join a religion? No, I didn't. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. If I joined a religion, I wouldn't be here. Previously, I was raised as a Christian, and by coming an initiate, I didn't have to do that, but I was thinking, when I first heard about this process, and I first started getting into studying these teachings, I was thinking, well, I don't think I'll be an initiate. I'll just be like, you know, like George Harrison, you know, My Sweet Lord. I was a singer-songwriter, you know. I'll just go around and sing my songs and sing about the teachings of the Gita and not be an initiate. But then I thought about it, and I looked carefully at the teachings, and I saw that actually Krishna recommended for me to become an initiate. He says, the one who's the devotee is my real devotee. So I said, okay. I think I can have more power. See, my idea was to bring a spiritual revolution on the planet. Tried my best anyway. And I was thinking by writing songs and going around and singing, I could do that. But then I realized, actually, becoming an initiate, I'd have more potency. So I gave up the idea of being, of course, I still have some songs. I still write some stuff. You know, along the side, kind of like a hobby. I got a real nice song called Turn On Your Soul. You might like it. I'm getting ready to post that on CD Baby. I have one recording now. It's a little rough. I'm going to try to re-record it. I come back in the summer. And once I get it polished, I'm going to put it on CD Baby and see where it goes. So I haven't given up being a singer-songwriter, but I realized that being an initiate, I would actually have more power and influence than I would just going on as a singer-songwriter. Of course, George Harrison, he was not an initiate. Actually, he wanted to be. But my master said, no, you're doing fine the way you're doing it now. You don't need to be initiated. So I don't think I could ever have the potency of George Harrison, but one of the most amazing people in history. But I realized that by being an initiate, I could have, from my position, that would be the best position I could have for teaching people, becoming empowered to actually pass on this knowledge to others, you see. Becoming actually a dedicated disciple of my spiritual master. That would give me the most potency. But I didn't give up. Not that by becoming an initiated disciple, I tell Jesus goodbye, you know. No, I became I call this the perfection of Christianity, you see. Now I'm a perfect Christian. Somebody said, are you a Muslim? One time his friend said, are you a Muslim? I said, no, I'm a perfect Muslim, I told them. You see. As a Christian, I never could follow the Ten Commandments. Now I follow it as like a piece of cake for me, the Ten Commandments, you see. So it's not that becoming initiate, now you're into a certain religious sect. No. If that was the case, I never would have taken him, you see. Now you're into a scientific system under the guidance of a teacher to bring you to the perfectional stage where you become the perfect Christian, the perfect Hindu, the perfect philosopher, the perfect science, perfect everything. It's not identifying with a sect. Although I do wear the, you know, this marking, but to me it's not a sectarian marking. This is somebody says, "What's that on your forehead?" I said, "This is a symbol of somebody who was conquered over death." You see, if you like, I'll teach you how to conquer over death too. You see, of course, you wouldn't have to wear dress like this. You can be a Christian and do this. We have one Krishna Baptist minister who follows the Bhagavad Gita. Actually, he bases his sermons on the Bhagavad Gita, but he uses different terminology for doing so. Otherwise, he loses his job immediately. Instead of saying Krishna, he says God. And they go, "Wow, Reverend so-and-so is really fired up. He's getting them. His lectures are really powerful. Where do you get all this potency?" They don't realize he's chanting Hare Krishna at home every morning on his prayer beads before he goes to the church. He's a full-time Baptist minister. Reverend Reese. I won't give his last name. Can I get him fired? Because it'll be on the internet. So, what is the difference between being a devotee and being an initiate? Well, initiate means now you're very serious about becoming a perfect devotee in this lifetime. Because actually, we're all devotees of God by our very nature. Everyone's a devotee of God. But our devotion is manifested in God's external energy, His material energy, instead of to Him personally. You see? So, as an initiated disciple of my spiritual master, now I've committed myself to actually, you know, following certain principles here's a good example. Just like at UT, I've heard you can still audit classes. I did that back in the 60s. I audited a few classes, you see. What's the difference between a registered student or an auditor? Registered student means you can take it more seriously. You made a commitment. You paid your tuition. You know, you have to show up for all the exams, you see. Initiate means you're taking it very seriously. Okay, I'm becoming a disciple of the spiritual master. I'm going to do this. I have certain requirements, like a coursework. And by following this system, I'm going to come out as a better than a PhD at the end. I'll come out as a spiritually enlightened person at the end of this process, you see. So because I was serious about becoming spiritually enlightened, and I wanted to also be in the most potent, powerful position for doing something to help this poor, suffering world become lifted out of the quagmire that it's sinking in more deeply into practically every day, I became an initiate. Best decision I ever made. Here's another question. How do we develop our spiritual eyes? Well, you already have them. You don't have to. I'm not talking about the third eye. You actually have two spiritual eyes already. Right now, they're covered by lust, anger, greed, madness, illusion, and envy. But by meditating on the Supreme and serving the Supreme, as described in the Gita that you'll be getting into, and I haven't given all the details, that'll come out in the following weeks. This is just introduction. But by actually following the teachings of the Gita, here's a good example. Just like somebody whose vision is really sharp, they look out here and all they see is a blur. But you put corrective lenses on, now they can see perfectly, you see. So the Gita is corrective lenses, or it is a process of actually correcting the lenses within your eyes themselves so they can actually see God everywhere in due course. Actually, we're already seeing God, but He's completely out of focus. This is God's energy. This is God's manifested energy. He's expanded Himself as everything. At the same time, He's keeping His individual existence. So you're actually seeing His expanded energy right now. Wherever you look, you're seeing God directly. But He's completely out of focus. You see? totally out of focus. So these teachings will actually refine your vision, and gradually, God will come back into focus, and you'll see Krishna. That day will come, and you will see Krishna right there, the beautiful smiling face, his lotus eyes. You'll see everything. You'll see God once again as you previously saw him before you drifted away. So, any other questions? We have a couple of minutes left. Yes?
Why do we drift away, or what's, is there a purpose?
Curiosity killed the cat. It's really hard to explain. It's like saying, well, I really got the bad case of the flu, and I want to find out where I caught it. I got a fever. Well, I catch it over here at the school, or is it where I want to work? Maybe it was a grocery store. I got to find out how I caught the flu. I really got to find out. But why don't you, first of all, go cure yourself first, you see? To find out how I drifted away, it's an obvious curiosity, but it's more important to get resituated in your original position. And then you'll automatically know anyway at that point. But to go on a big search to try to figure out how is that I could possibly drift away? You know, how is it that Adam and Eve could ever be tempted to eat that forbidden apple? You see what I'm saying? Instead of worrying so much about how we drifted away, get back to where you once belonged. Make that your focus. And then when you get there, you'll immediately understand how it is you drifted away. But in our present state, it's practically impossible to understand how we could have drifted away from God. It's practically impossible to understand. Our spiritual master said, misuse of independence. And if you want a real simple answer, I misused my independence. How we could do it, why we do it, that's difficult to understand. But first get over the flu, and then maybe you can figure out where you caught it. Anything else? Is there something I didn't answer here? Oh, what is the meaning of Bhagavad Gita? Oh, okay. Basic question for Bhagavad Gita course. Bhagavad means God. It's Bhagavan means the supreme, means that person who is full of all opulences. Bhaga means opulences, and van, it changes to the ending changes. Just like a apple becomes an apple. The word, when a vowel follows the letter A, it becomes an N. Don't say a apple, you say an apple. You stick an N in there. So in Sanskrit also, the word endings change sometimes. So Bhagavan becomes Bhagavad Gita. So, but Bhaga means all opulence, namely power, renunciation, power, beauty, renunciation, knowledge, wealth, and fame are the six opulences. And Van means one who possesses these. So that person who possesses unlimited power, unlimited beauty, unlimited renunciation, unlimited knowledge, unlimited fame, and unlimited wealth, that person is the supreme, according to this definition of the great sage Parashara Muni. And Gita means song. So that song about that supreme person who possesses all opulences. That's the meaning of Bhagavad Gita. Those of you who are from America, mostly seem to be from America. But one of our great American philosophers was Thoreau. We studied him in high school. You all studied Thoreau in high school, Walden Pond. You remember what he said in Walden Pond? The quote is right here. Right out of Walden Pond, Thoreau says, "In the morning I bathe my intellect in the stupendous and cosmogonal philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, in comparison with which our modern world and its literature seem puny and trivial." So the great American philosopher has confirmed this is a great book to study. He personally studied it. And this way your whole life will become a wonderful Walden Pond existence. If you study Gita every day, you'll have a Walden Pond existence. He was a great philosopher, Thoreau, and he had a great perspective. He was vegetarian, actually, and he was arguing with one farmer who said, "You got to eat meat to be strong. How you can be a vegetarian and be strong?" And guess what was pulling the plow? They didn't have tractors in those days. They had a powerful vegetarian ox who was pulling the plow. He said, "You can't be strong if you don't eat meat." And this big, powerful ox is a vegetarian. The farmer couldn't see this, you see. So anyway, Bhagavad Gita will give you a lot of enlightenment. You know, everybody can get some benefit, whether you, whatever degree you want to practice it, that's up to you. But I guarantee you this, whatever, any study you do of it, it'll unlimitedly benefit your life. So we thank you all very, very much for attending the introductory session of our Bhagavad Gita course. I'm actually heading out to India next Saturday, so I won't be here, but you'll be teaching some classes now.
Yes.
So Mahasundari Madhavi is very qualified. She's also an initiate, by the way. And she's a very qualified teacher. So you look forward to a wonderful adventure, Bhagavad Gita, and I hope to see you all when I get back from India. Thank you very much.
Thank you.